Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. President Trump is back in power and immediately moved to carry out his xenophobic, cruel, hateful, and racist policies with a slew of unconstitutional executive orders and plans for mass detention and deportation of the nation's immigrants. On today's program, we talked to three extraordinary activists whose organizations and coalitions are building effective solidarity and defense for the about-to-be-detained and deported. Victor Naro, UCLA's longtime expert on immigrant rights and low-wage workers, works in the sanctuary movement. Nana Gyanthi of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration and Aquilina Soriano-Versosa from the Filipino Workers Center of Southern California explain what their Black, Latino, and Filipino-led and focused organizations are doing to counter the Trump offensive. This is practical solidarity that builds power, and it is moving and uplifting. So stay tuned when our program returns in just a moment. And welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman, and today we're going to focus on efforts from organizations who are building effective solidarity and defense for those about to be detained and possibly deported. As we are only too well aware, President Trump is back in power and has wasted no time in trying to implement his racist, xenophobic policies with unconstitutional executive orders and plans to carry out his campaign promise of mass detention and deportation of the nation's immigrants. He also promised on his first day in office to close the U.S. border with Mexico and to restrict migrants from seeking asylum. These policies, if carried out, and that's still a question, have the potential to profoundly disrupt daily life in Los Angeles and Southern California, if not, you know, all of California, the nation. But here in Los Angeles, one in three residents are immigrants, and something like 8% lack legal authorization, according to a 2024 USC Dornsite report. And we're already getting reports of ICE activity, as well as reports from San Bernardino, where the mayor has set up checkpoints. Anti-immigrant xenophobic policies are low-hanging fruit historically. Politicians, political candidates, newspapers, media moguls, they've all whipped up anti-immigrant sentiment in this country as part of right-wing populist tactics for a very long time, particularly during economic downturns. And the consequences have been real: total exclusion and mass deportation. So today we're going to start with Victor Naro, longtime expert on immigrant rights and low-wage workers. He's now working in the sanctuary movement. Nana Gyanthi of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration and Aquilina Soriano-Versosa from the Filipino Workers Center of Southern California will be joining us. Let me just begin by giving our listeners, telling them who you are, if they don't already know. So Victor Naro is a nationally known expert on immigrant rights and low-wage workers. He's been involved with this for probably 40 or so years, as well as labor issues. And he's currently the project director with UCLA Labor Center and the core faculty for the UCLA Department of Labor Studies, where he teaches courses that focus on immigrant rights and low-wage workers and the labor movement, and is now working in the sanctuary movement and has been doing that, he tells me, at least since his student days, his activist days of the early 80s. But now he's more involved with creating sanctuary policies. And Nana Gyanthi is the executive director of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. She's also a programmer at KPFK and brings with her over three decades of service to the movement for Black liberation and over 20 years experience directing Black social justice organizations and networks. And she's also a human rights and criminal defense attorney and a professor in the Pan-African Studies Department at Cal State LA, and does two radio shows. And there's so much more to say about her. But I just want to say welcome to both of you and to begin the program by saying how fortunate we are to have you both, veteran organizers who are also lawyers, So I kind of want to begin with Trump's assault on the 14th Amendment, birthright clause, which he tried to eviscerate with an executive order on his very first day in office. It's already been challenged by a judge in Seattle, and the ACLU and other organizations have also filed lawsuits. But it begs the question, why would he announce a clearly unconstitutional move with an executive order? And I also just want to say that birthright citizenship is certainly part of the 14th Amendment, but another section of the 14th Amendment, that's Section 3, the insurrection bar, according to legal experts, should have prevented Trump from holding office because of his participation in an insurrection. And so he was disqualified, but it's really too late to even discuss that because obviously didn't stop him. So, but now that this birthright citizenship is under attack, it really raises the legitimate question of why Trump thinks he can overturn a constitutional amendment with an executive order. And so I'd like to start with either one of you wants to begin on just that constitutional issue.
Thank you for having us on the show. So excited and happy to be here. Let me say that with this president, it's not so much about what he thinks he can do. It's, what he wants to do. And he will throw it out there. And then if it turns out that, okay, he gets stopped or it gets limited in some other kind of way, he's satisfied with that, right? I think one of the things and one of the frustrations that I know we've had at Bajie and, some of our partners and colleagues is that when it comes to those of us that are trying to build this world and looking at electeds that claim they're with us, they always want to be practical and sort of, operate within the lowest hanging fruit humanly possible, as opposed to reaching for the highest fruit. And we don't want them to reach for a fruit that is unconstitutional, but just even higher than what we've gotten. And on this other side, they don't care. They're reaching past where they should even be going to try to get then their hope somewhere along the way, something that is not quite what they're asking for, but at least gives them enough to do what they want to do. And the main point of this, as far as we can see, two points. Number one, to create divisiveness. It starts talking about Dred Scott, trying to make sure that Black Americans know that, oh, we're not talking about you. We're talking about these other people, because birthright citizenship, of course, is how African Americans are African Americans. So they know that Black folks who are multi-generational would be very concerned about this. So we had to make the point to separate them out, creating that divisiveness. And then when you look at the way that it talks, it's still rooted in that racism. Basically, if your mother was enslaved, you're enslaved. And if your mother is undocumented, then now you're undocumented. And so it's still rooted in that enslavement time period, that time period that's the foundation of this country once again, and the foundation of this policy.
How do you see it, Victor, as
Yeah,
someone,
I
I mean,
mean,
clearly, yeah, go ahead, go ahead.
I totally agree with Nana. These are ideological, politically motivated, hateful attacks, and the MAGA and the Trump strategy functions like that. They throw threats, intimidation, they bullies, they try to create instill fear with the hope that they overwhelm us and cause others to take up action. I mean, look at January 6th, the insurrection. You empower these groups to feel like that they got the green light to engage in hateful attacks. And because while we're talking about this, the birthright citizenship yesterday in Newark, US citizens were rounded up by ICE agents. They're using collateral arrest. They feel like they can get away with it. I mean, they're empowered to what they feel like they can do to accomplish their goals, and they feel like they're above the law. And I think Trump has been instilling this in, ICE and other federal agencies. We got some great lawyers in the movement that will deal with the litigation strategies to counter that. But we also need to really be aware that there's going to be stuff on the streets that's going to be harmful. And what happened in Newark yesterday is an example. And I think I have no doubt it's going to come to Los Angeles. And that's why I think people like Nana, myself, a coalition of organizations, we're working on the base building piece to how the communities can defend themselves. If you look at what happened in Congress this week, the Laken Riley Act, it's a wake-up call that the Dems are not always with us. And,
No.
this hateful legislation now is going to be signed by President Trump. And then you mentioned in the beginning, your introduction, Susie, that the Trump deportation policy, we've always been under attack, people of color. Obama's deportation policy netted almost 3 million deportations. We've always had to deal with issues of attacks by federal agencies, attacked by different policies. It hasn't always been Republicans, it's also been Democrats. And this is why I think, we really need to go back to the process of first, really immediate priorities should always be base building and
But I wanted
politics.
to ask if either one of you thought that he was essentially baiting the Supreme Court to take this up and try somehow to adjudicate a different understanding of the 14th Amendment. Of course, that doesn't seem like it's possible. It would require a rewriting of the Constitution, but it just seems to me he's a crazy guy. He shoots from the hip, but this one is so blatantly unconstitutional. I wonder what you thought, apart from, as you both have said, empowering people to go into the streets and take these matters into their own hands. Legally, what do you think?
Because this Supreme Court has shifted so much to the right, it is like you do get concerned about how they will handle this type of topic. And but again, I said, we have the strategy, right? We have to then be there to post the best legal arguments. The National Labor Relations Act is another example. That's they're trying to get that to the Supreme Court as well, and that's the right to organize for workers in this country. And so, but there's legal strategies on how to deal with that. And but I think it shouldn't take us away from what I think is the heart and soul of what we need to do is the base building, the community organizing.
And Nana, do you have anything to add to that?
I mean, I would just, agree, of course, with Victor on the focus of the organizing. And I think the narrative building, the understanding that we can have about the effort, it's really about creating, like giving them the space in terms of the Supreme Court to write up something that is going to probably say, yes, it's unconstitutional. However, there's this and this and this. Remember that also happened during the Trump administration before, where the Supreme Court sort of gave nods to things, and then those things may become other forms of legislation that are not executive orders, but are actually getting pushed through by Congress. But in the era of who's going to check me, boo, that's what I call this era, right? The response is the people. It's, I hate to say it, it's not going to be litigation that's going to be the big check. It's not going to be legislation that's going to be the big check. Attorneys are going to cry. They're going to cry when they hear this because they are so used to being the sun in the universe. But that's not what it's going to be. History has shown us that who it's going to be is the people. And so when we're talking about taking away birthright citizenship, how do we, which is what Baji folks like Victor and others are working on, how do we describe this to our people in a way that they understand why they have a constitution? What does it mean to have a constitutional right? Why is that important? How does that relate to their everyday condition? How does it, make their condition worse in terms of the material conditions of their lives if this issue is resolved in a particular way? And so why should they take this up as something that they're concerned about, right? Because we know this country has a lot of people that have a notion, it's so individualistic so often that it's like, well, I made it through, so okay, too bad for you. If things change, just change and you'll just have to deal with it differently. And I think people, it's going to be important for us to make sure that our folks are very clear, not just about how this impacts them in terms of their access to benefits, et cetera, but w the fact that citizenship in this country is so connected to basic humanity, and that that's really what this was. When enslaved Africans were granted citizenship in the United States, it wasn't just about, oh, you get to be a part of this country now. They were already a part of the country. They'd already labored and built this country for 400 plus years. It was more that it indicated that they were no longer the three-fifths of a person, that they had the rights to all of the things that citizens had the rights to. And so it is a question also of human rights and human dignity beyond the nationalistic pieces, right? The flag part is not so important. It's the other pieces. And that's what we need to get our people plugged into.
I actually want Victor to give you a chance to talk about what this means in terms of the work that you're involved in. And it's sort of like, I mean, you're doing the sanctuary work, but you're also doing immigrant workers' defense. Maybe you should just describe it because I want to talk about all the
Yeah.
efforts that people are involved in and how much you're working with other organizations as well to coordinate.
We've had a sanctuary coalition in Los Angeles for some time now. I mean, this goes back to like 10 years ago that we started the effort to try to create a policy in Los Angeles where city officials, not just LAPD, but all city departments, especially city departments like LAPD, Department of Transportation, Bureau of Street Services, they're out on the streets, they do enforcement. That they did not cooperate or engage or participate in any immigration enforcement activities. And then also the important thing about sanctuary policy today versus the 1980s is the surveillance. You know, since 9/11, the Patriot Act really gave a green light to federal law enforcement in this country to do what they want to do, especially to surveillance, selective targeting of individuals. It's given them the green light to do that. And I think we've become like a national security surveillance country because of what happened at post 9/11. And sanctuary policies today are important also for data sharing. There's a lot of data brokers that have information on all of us. They share that data. City contracts with these data brokers and they share all that data with immigration and other federal officials and put a limit on that as well. You know, not just the physical, right? Not allowing ICE to enter into city premises, city buildings without a judicial warrant or not cooperating with them on enforcement. But also the data stuff that we often don't see, but the data sharing is happens everywhere, and it's become a post 9/11 concern of civil liberties, and so try to put restriction on that. But I think sanctuary policies, what they do is they give us breathing space to do the organizing, because then we don't have to worry about then the entanglement between city departments and immigration officials, but then it allows us the space then to devote it to organizing, because sanctuary policy is not going to prevent ICE. They kind of come to LA, I have no doubt. They've always, you know, there's always been the federal enforcement action in LA, but this is like an announcement of a major deportation enforcement policy. But what sanctuary policies do is like we don't have to worry up then about the entanglement between city departments, city officials, LAPD, and ICE. We can focus then on the base building, how to prevent, how to protect, and how to build strong community, be there for one another when ICE do show up or when they do make their presence.
So you don't think, for example, when Newsom says that California won't cooperate with ICE on these policies, you don't think that's going to happen?
Well, we had the California Values Act, which came out in 2017, the SB 54, which we're trying to strengthen now because it does have its limitations. But this type of policies of non-cooperation, non-participation, but these policies don't prevent immigration enforcement from coming into our spaces. But then we have to then figure out the strategy how to deal with that. And that's why I think sanctuary policy at least allows us to shift the resources to focus on community defense. You know.
You know, I've been looking at this, you know, in preparation essentially for talking to all of you. And it's kind of gratifying to see how many organizations around the country, but also in California and the Inland Empire and elsewhere, are working on rapid defense networks, numbers to call, and instructions on what to do. You know, because you're involved, both of you are involved. Is there coordination between all the various organizations? Give our listeners a kind of lay of the land so we understand like which organizations are out there and what they're doing. You know, and Nana's certainly come in on this too with the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. You know, when I first hear that, I keep thinking myself immigration justice, but this is even better the way that it's formed. And then I want to come back to the actual sanctuary work because we have an example from the 80s of the sanctuary movement.
Well,
So,
we had the Sanctuary Coalition. You know, Baji's part of that. The coalition, immigrant rights groups, Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights,
Chula,
CADESIN,
yeah, and Carson, right.
the California Immigrant Policy Center, Immigrant Defenders, Justice Law Center, and others. And we had a big planning meeting yesterday to try to figure out like rapid response, who's doing that. We're trying to be coordinated. Because legal services, we have the Representation LA program now with the county and the city with provides resources to the legal services providers that can provide them lawyers if, you know, individuals do get caught up in deportation proceedings. And then we there's a network of whoever has the capacity to provide communications, digital media. We have a strategy on that based on the organizations that are able to provide that. There are some good. Know your rights. What happens is that there's a lot of webinars on Know Your Rights out there, and we're trying to coordinate that so that if anybody, no matter where you are in LA County or there's a statewide coalition now in California, we'll know what you can connect with, so you don't have to spend too much time trying to find the coordination. It's always hard, right? Because we're involved in so many different spaces, but the more we're coordinated, it's good for strategically for using. Better use the resources, but I just think it creates solidarity. Like we have to be there for each other because we've always been under attack, and it's just not like because the focus now is immigrant communities, but the Black community has always been under attack. A lot of the issues that impact immigrant communities also impact Black communities, and Los Angeles historically has not been good in many ways for communities of color. And so this is falls into the landscape of this overarching struggle, and that's what we coordination of resources of different networks and who's doing what also invites the opportunity for us to create strong solidarity and community with one another.
Right. And what are you doing with the Black Alliance, Nana, on these issues? I know that defense is one thing. I saw one thing on your website about the Lake and Riley Initiative. And just talk a little bit for our listeners about the work that you're involved in.
So, for most Black migrants that get caught up in the deportation machine, it's through the police to deportation pipeline. It is through the fact that as Black people, we are racially profiled, we are, overarrested, overcharged, oversentenced, etc. Even in California, almost 80% of Black migrants who are deported because of some kind of contact with the police. And obviously, at least on the federal side, Lincoln Riley Act is not going to get better. It's certainly, it's something we need to be concerned about. The other piece with Black migrants is that often the cultural competence aspect is missing for us when most people think about immigration. They don't think about Black migrants. So even in the state of California, we fight, even with the city of Los Angeles, just to get French, just to get them to translate things into French, which is still a colonizer language, right? But is not a language that they associate with immigrants and therefore not a language that they have on the table. And so there's one piece of it, which for us is really the cop is a cop. And making it clear to our community members that we actually need to look at enforcement as one machine that uses each other's, resources, whether those resources be the handcuffs, the guns, the bullets, the surveillance machine, all of that is one piece. If they work with each other, even when they're not supposed to work with each other, when it comes to people that are being accused of criminal conduct, right? And so the sanctuary does not help you in that context, which is why Bajie, along with other organizations, had been pushing freedom cities, not Donald Trump's freedom cities, our freedom cities that actually represent freedom for a sanctuary, not just from immigration enforcement, but also from criminal punishment system enforcement and other forms of enforcement that catch up Black folks. And so that's one piece. And so our Know Your Rights are about looking at the system generally and, giving people their rights in that way. The other piece is the cultural competence. And so not only is it around making sure that we have the KYR cards and languages that our people understand, because our French is different than French in Paris, right? But also in making sure that we have verbal and video Know Your Rights, because all of our languages are, even if they're written, it doesn't mean that people are used to reading them. And things like WhatsApp, for example, is one way that we share a lot of information. And so it allows us to be able to do that in verbal and audio ways that people are more familiar with, right? It's almost like your own little TikTok, even though you're not on TikTok, right? And making something that people are willing to look at and willing to share. So those are two big pieces of what we're doing. And then obviously the advocacy, because we do need to tighten up. We do need to take it from sanctuary to freedom cities. We do need to make sure that those who are not supposed to be entangling with ICE are not entangling with ICE. And we do need to do that base building. especially in places like California. Mbaji's also in Texas. We're also in Georgia. We're also in Florida. Those states have long been different than California, right? And so we're going to take those lessons and bring those lessons to our people here so that we can understand how are people surviving, thriving, and pushing back there and making sure that we don't get too comfortable over here in California and in Los Angeles thinking that we're safe because of sanctuary.
What about, and this is something you can both answer. I wanted to ask both of you about this sort of, historical divide and conquer and the way that immigrant communities and communities of color have been pitted against each other. And even now, you can look at Trump bragging that he won more African Americans to vote, won more Latino votes. And I'm not asking you to comment on who voted for him, but the way that these communities either do work together or don't work together, and especially on this issue of defense and protection. And of course, you both mentioned solidarity. So, are there efforts there, and how real is this? And I'm just thinking because historically, migrants have been brought in from other places into a system that's always criminalized people of color. We had people who've been caged and deprived of their fundamental rights. And we had, historically, we had importing Chinese labor and then the Bracero program and other. Ways of dealing with this. It now seems that it's more massive and it's coming from everywhere. And I'm really appreciative of, your intervention there now on the need for having things in French, recognizing where immigrants are coming from and what their needs are. But is there still like a difficulty in, the issue of solidarity between communities?
I'll speak first and say yes and no. It is definitely more virulent in the virtual world than it is in the actual world. And I think that's important to say because, people are so clued into like what's going on Instagram, what's happening on TikTok, what's happening on X, what's happening here, what's happening there. And then they try to act like that's the actual world. That is not the actual world, right? In the actual world, we are married to one another, let alone working together and going to school together and doing all these other things together. Does that mean that there's not a tension there? There has always been a tension there. That is, the nature of capitalism. There's a reason we're trying to address this capitalism question, right? I mean, that's the nature of
Absolutely.
it. It causes people to compete and makes it easy to tell people and convince people that they need to do that. For us, for example, when it comes to Black migrants, African Americans, we have a campaign that's called Blackness Is, which is really reminding ourselves that the notion of Blackness and the understanding of what it means to be Black is actually more expanded than what this divisive narrative would have people believe, right? To make sure that people understand that when it comes to our communities, that we have all these examples in current time. You don't have to go back to the 60s and 70s when we are working and fighting together. And also, really focusing on how do we move people's mindset from abandonment to abundance? Because you do have an abandonment that has happened on the part of government, and in some cases, are never picked up, right? Not even abandoned, just never, always oppressed and marginalized. And then you bring other people into that with the intention of causing these divisions. And so, how do we think about ourselves actually as an abundant community, as opposed to an abandoned community? And what are the notions of the sweet life, as I like to call it, as opposed to the soft life, right? This communal sweet life that we are able to live with one another when we recognize and treat one another with dignity and respect.
And those are the words. I want to just welcome Aquila Soriano Versosa to the program now. Thank you so much for joining us. Let me just tell the listeners that Aggie is the executive director of the Filipino Worker Center of Southern California. And that's an organization that's been working to protect domestic workers and caregivers from overtime wage theft and human trafficking. And it's also part of the Immigrant and Labor Leaders and has reformed, as I'm sure she's going to tell us, the Rapid Response Network to Protect Immigrants and other initiatives that we're going to discuss. So welcome to the program. And I should just, we've talked so far a little bit about what the 14th Amendment challenge is going to mean or the reason behind it. And we're also hearing a little bit about Victor's work with immigrant justice and sanctuary and the work of Baji. And why don't you take this opportunity right now to talk a little bit about what your organization is doing? And it comes in the framework of talking about different coalitions working together in this moment, not pitting them against each other, and what kind of work you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me on. Yes, so Filipino Worker Center and myself, we are really in a lot of coalitions that are both about immigrants, like Immigrants RLA, that's focused on the county, but also with worker coalitions, the California Coalition for Worker Power, the Los Angeles Worker Center Network, the California Domestic Workers Coalition. And in this moment, it's really important that we don't become siloed as a movement in issues. And when immigration issues are so intertwined with worker issues, that it's really important that we are aligning all of our organizations to really understand what those intersections are, what the implications are in this moment of mass deportations on the vulnerability and exploitation of workers, and how we can align worker leaders and worker organizations together with immigrant rights and immigrant organizations to have united calls so that even if we're advocating in immigration spaces for immigration-specific things that we are considering and really integrating in that worker piece, because so much of immigration attacks are to make immigrants vulnerable workers who can be exploited, as Nana talked about, the underlying foundation of capitalism. It's immigrants who are leading a lot of the worker organizing, efforts that have been, at the forefront, like domestic workers. And so workers are such an important voice around all these different issues, both immigrant rights, workers' rights, but also just issues about our democracy. And there's such a fundamental intersection that I'm working very hard in Filipino Worker Center in all of these coalitions to just bring us all together so that we can be even stronger in our advocacy and in our organizing efforts.
Victor, why don't you come in? Because, certainly this whole issue of immigrants is fundamentally a labor issue, as Aki just mentioned, and Nana too. And this is, also historically, as I said, it's kind of the low-hanging fruit, and it's the way immigrants have been brought in as low-wage, super-exploited labor. And then once they're here, don't have the same protections, that others do, and even, and you could argue that everyone is under attack with this presidency and with this offensive. I'm not going to forgive the Democrats. They certainly blew it just now on the NLRB appointments, somehow sleeping through when they could have been fighting. But what or how do you see your work, Victor, as you're head of the labor center on this issue, and you're also working in sanctuary and other issues?
Yeah, I mean the biggest development for us in this area has been climate change. What we just witnessed the last 2 weeks are horrific fires and catastrophe. It's a sign of what's to come, and immigrant workers are the frontline second responders. They're gonna be there to get rid of the debris, to do some of the toxic cleanup. Many of them are not gonna be given protective equipment. Many of them are gonna be exposed to toxic chemicals, and this is why we need to now focus on protecting the rights of immigrants when they get called up to do the second responder work post the natural disaster, because it's going to continue throughout the country. Climate change is going to create havoc in our weather patterns. We're going to see many natural disasters. They're going to rely on the immigrant workforce to do different kinds of follow-up work to provide for the recovery, the recuperation, the post natural disaster work. This is happening before Trump. I mean, put aside the Trump factor, this is something we've all been struggling with. I think, to Nana's point, capitalism thrives on division. Like, there's no such thing as not having enough in the budget. There's enough wealth in this country that everyone can have a quality of life. This country is so wealthy and so many, but it's concentrated. It's monopolized, and And then they're told, we're told, like, there's not enough. We got to figure it out. We can only do $20 an hour, not $30 an hour. My latest data on LA poverty shows $36 an hour is what we need in Los Angeles, way above the $16, $17 an hour minimum wage that we have now. And it keeps going up. But there's enough wealth in this country that everybody can have a quality of life. And it's just, we just, that's why I just think we need to be the more intersectional, the more we are together, working together side by side and not being peeled off. That's how the system survives on that. It's just really, making us struggle for the crumbs
Yeah,
and not go for the whole pie, you know?
let me ask each of you to address the issue of how you're organizing. I guess part of that question is whether or not you believe that Trump is actually going to be able to deport what 11 million immigrants, or whether or not he'll just perhaps deport those already in the pipeline and who have criminal records and then say mission accomplished, much like he did with the wall before. On the other hand, that's a luxury to even assume that he might not. You have to plan and organize now, just in case. So I'd like to hear about your ideas about that and then concretely what you're doing. We'll come back to you, Victor, on the sanctuary part of it, the sanctuary piece, which is very important. But I also want to hear about the protection, defense, and solidarity, community outreach, building supporting communities to help. One of the examples that I like to think of is back in the 30s during, the Depression, and you had sheriffs showing up at people's places to evict them or foreclose them. And even before cell phones and, and pagers and all the rest of it, communities were organized to stand in front of those sheriffs and their people, trying to evict people and to stop it. We saw a little bit about that from that during Occupy, where people could text a line and if there was going to be a foreclosure, they'd show up. I'd like to see that kind of effort nationwide, wherever we see ICE activity trying to go into a neighborhood or an apartment block or at a bus stop, and all of a sudden you get an army of people preventing ICE from doing that. Is that a fantasy, or is that something that, what kinds of things are you doing? That's really what I want to know. And let's start with Nana, and then I guess go to Aki and then Victor.
Okay, well, I'm not going to talk about exactly what we're doing. So let's start with that. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to be more secure about talking about our tactics and the things that we're going to be doing. Because as Victor pointed out before, we are living in a surveillance state. I mean, I think there's some things that, as you've already pointed out, Susan, that are obvious, right? So people are engaging in coalitions that are looking at rapid response, that are making sure that our folks have information, as much information as they can have, to at least be empowered to know what, they can do, to know what processes look like, to know what processes they can engage in, to, have it so that if you do get stopped on and your children are in school, that it's not just total chaos, that you have something that you've thought of before. And I think, I was telling folks, I was in Ghana during the time of these terrible fires when I came back. By the time I came back, I know the fires are still happening, but a lot of the devastation had already occurred. But it reminds you that emergency preparedness is emergency preparedness, right? And that there is something about knowing the process, knowing what's going on, knowing what your rights are, knowing what your capabilities are, your own capacity is, because people have different levels of capacity, even folks with disabilities, et cetera. So it's like, knowing and having a sense is really important. So that's a piece that we're definitely doing with our people and adding the cultural competence piece to that, really trying to focus on keeping our people from being too panicked because there's a lot of chaos that's intended. And I think that's a piece that, allowing other folks to talk, obviously, and bring their brilliance to this question, that's a piece that is not necessarily talked about enough, that some of this is to create so much chaos that people will say, hey, I'm out of here. Right? The reason why you can have mass incarceration is 98% of the people that go to prisons and jails plead out their case, right? They don't try their case. They don't push their case in court. And so that is going to be a big push, I predict, and what they're going to be doing is trying to get people to either be so terrified that they voluntarily deport or almost come up with a deal process that's going to have people being willing to give themselves up in order to protect maybe other people in the family. family. I can see a lot of wheeling and dealing that we haven't even thought about happening in order to get a lot of people to agree to be deported so that they don't have to kind of put up the machine that they would have to put up to do the impossible task of 11 million deportations.
Okay, let's hear from you, Akian. Your organization has done work with domestic workers, which are often among the most exploited, or let's say hidden. And, we've seen in the past where ICE have shown up at bus stops where people are trying to get to work. What kind of stuff are you doing for protecting, defending?
Even after the elections, we started training. And so, with Know Your Rights training, within the first 2 weeks, we had trained over 400 individuals and are building out more of our capacity. We actually have been building out member-led teams in different geographic areas to be able to lead this different work around wage theft, but also now really about immigrant rights, so that we can build our capacity to get that information. Because what we saw in the first administration is that people in our community were opening the doors, thinking that if they're cooperative, that it will be better, but really learning about like not opening the doors unless there's a warrant, and how ICE operates and tries to get everyone they can touch or are in the vicinity of, not just, they don't do targeted approaches. They try and get as many as possible. So really not opening the door, not signing voluntary departures, deportations papers, which they think they're also just cooperating and are coerced before they can even get to legal representation. And then really building in a message that we're stronger and safer together, that it's not going to be safer to hide, but actually it's going to be safer to come together in strong networks, like you talked about with the eviction defense. So we're also doing very much local work so that people are identifying who they can call and rely on in their local neighborhoods, building out a neighborhood caring communities that are not just the workers, but others in their communities. Because the thing with domestic workers is that, employers are a whole spectrum of folks, and there are a lot of employers that are real allies as well. So we also saw like sanctuary, kind of a sanctuary movement of domestic worker employers with their workers, during the first Trump era. So that's something, again, like providing support for that, to build that kind of resilience. And then, I mean, we're more prepared this time than before, because we have the experience of the first Trump era and know that they are going to trying to go into the neighborhoods. Like you said, there's, incidents at bus stops and workplace raids as well, doing I-9 audits. So it's important for us to be prepared and actually to educate employers about what they can do during a raid to also protect their workers, how to separate information that things that they do have to show and things that they wouldn't have to show if it wasn't together, for example, areas that can be private and not accessed by ICE. And we also have our Rapid Response Network, which is really the different organizations that are signing up, led, this is like really being led by CIRLA and California Immigrant Policy Center, as well as together with unions, SEIU, California Labor Fed, really showing up to say that at any time, if we get that call, no matter what time of night, we are going to show up when it's needed.
Yes.
Yes. And
Perfect.
we're talking to the Labor Commissioner's office just so that she can be aligned, because there's so much good laws that we've also passed and roles that, like the Labor Commissioner's office can play during worksite raids, for example, and things that they can do to protect workers.
Victor, this is a time for you to come in and talk about this. And, right at the outset in the introduction, I talked about what the impact would be just on Southern California if all the immigrants were somehow removed and what it would do to daily life. That 1 in 3 residents in California are immigrants, and that 8% of them lack any legal authorization, let's say. What would happen there? And then talk a little bit about the sanctuaries, because historically, well, at least in the, when you started doing sanctuary work as a student, it was setting up safe places, literally, especially during the wars in Central America for Salvadorans and others who were not only escaping violence, but were death squads were operating on our streets here too. So talk a little bit about the history of that and how you see it playing in
So
now.
the 1980s, back then it was really human to human engagement because we didn't have like cell phones or we didn't have emails back then. It was all really, we rely on ourselves being there for each other physically. There was not, they couldn't text someone in 15 minutes late for a meeting because there was no way to text. But I think there's a value to that, right? Because in person, face to face engagement, being there, human to human connection creates that kind of uplift amongst ourselves that then it makes us better use all the instruments that we have, like text message, you know, the like Signal, the WhatsApp. I think we gotta keep that because I think that's what's gonna help us. That's where you create that in the strong solidarity. And back then, you know, we didn't have a lot of the nonprofits, so there was like very few, like there were virtually very few, very little like immigrant rights groups in the 80s. It was really like human networking. And we had to be also then there for each other in solidarity because there was a lot of federal prosecution. I had friends that ended up in federal prison because of, you know, the Reagan administration was going after everybody. It's just trying to federal crimes we were facing. We always had to be careful about surveillance. We had, you know, make sure that we support one another and not leave anybody behind. We harbored family, you know, the churches were very much about the Quakers, the Unitarian churches. Today we have that strong interfaith coalition network, but we gotta make sure like we all create that kind of strong solidarity that then makes it so much more powerful when we use all the instruments that we have.
It seems like there's more too, like you're talking about that. And I remember the role of the churches. I don't remember at the time so much from the unions, but now you're getting a sort of broader solidarity that's worker-based, immigrant-based, different racial organizations, and the churches as well. So all of that seems really good. But then on the other hand, Trump is so much worse than Reagan was on this issue.
We have so many issues we're dealing with then compared to the 1980s. But then I think, as Aki mentioned, we've done a good job, I think, in the last few years, especially since the pandemic, of we understood like why we cannot be siloed. We really got to be strongly connected, intersectional. Our first major challenge now is the issue of the criminal conviction or being charged. Because my concern is the Laken Riley Act passing is my concern is that's going to lead us back to this narrative that happened under the Obama administration of good immigrant versus bad immigrant.
Can you briefly just
From
tell the listeners what the Laken Riley?
you could be charged. You could be given the issue a ticket for misdemeanor and be subject to deportation. You don't even have to be convicted anymore. And you know, it's a harmful. You could be finger pointed for alleged to have committed a misdemeanor or some other offense, and that could be subject you to deportation. And I just cannot. It's beyond me the fact that the Democrats didn't filibuster this. They had enough votes to filibuster it, but they didn't in the Senate. And I think my concern is we're going back to that narrative of you can go after them if you leave them alone. Because I think it's a harmful narrative when you go when you start to target people who have either committed a crime in the past and already have integrated back into society, or are alleged to have committed a misdemeanor or some kind of offense, and say like, okay, you can take them but not leave the rest. We just gotta make sure we don't subject ourselves to that kind of harmful narrative. So I think that's coming up with. It's gotta be we gotta be there for each other. Totally, and not have them peel off different groups and that division, you know, because I think that's how they thrive when they cause that division within us.
Nan, I noticed on your website, the Bajie website, there's a whole thing about Laken Riley. And so your organization is at least doing some knowledge campaign around it. Is that right?
Yeah, we were doing some let's not have it happen, understanding that, you know, the votes were there, at least in the House, and really trying to push the Senate to do the filibuster that Victor just referred to, because again, as we talk about Black migrants and the main way that we are deported is the police deportation pipeline. When you now say that people can just be accused, when you say people can be held indefinitely in detention, when you say that people will not be able to get a bond, now we're, in a scary place, and it's blanket. So it covers the documented, it covers people with temporary protective status that this administration sees as all being undocumented, right? Which in a way is, it helps us, not in terms of its action, but in terms of the narrative, because again, I think as Victor is saying, we really have to not have people thinking or allowing them to do this, oh, you're a more deserving immigrant, you're a less deserving immigrant. The criminalized always get pushed to the bottom. The undocumented always get pushed to the bottom. The folks that are not as, high wage get pushed to the bottom, and they're trying to focus on the H-1B people and et cetera, et cetera. And so it's really important that we, again, push the understanding to folks that we are all in this together, that it is community that's going to be our power. As I said, if the question is who's going to check me, boo, the answer is going to have to be us, not as individuals, not as a certain set of people who are marginalized and vulnerable, but as all of us who believe in the liberation of the people on the planet.
Yeah, excellent. We have about, I don't know, 5 minutes or so left, and I'd like to hear, let's start with Aki about concrete things that you think people should be doing and talking to each other. And also, like, if people want to get in touch with your organization, each of you, let's hear the website or whatever it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, folks can reach out to us. Filipino Worker Center is at pwcsc.org. And there you can connect to a whole bunch of resources, to our hotline, to upcoming trainings, to how to volunteer also and become a part of a neighborhood caring community. We're also having a lot of wildfire response as well, so people can volunteer. And really taking a mutual aid approach as well, like how we can all help out together. So, but another thing is that it is really important to spread the word and have good communications. And like Cheryl has amazing communications to follow about, like to understand also what's happening and resources as well. Immigrants for Los Angeles, Immigrants RLA, which is immigrantslosangeles.org, also is going to be a hub for all different kinds of immigrant resources in language that people can access. And there is a national hotline now for Asian American, AAPI, Asian American Pacific Islander communities as well. And that's available on our website, pwcsc.org.
Nanak, give your information too, please.
I know we don't have lots of time. So Baji,
Yeah.
BAJI, that's at BAJI.org. We are, putting up materials. We have explainers for a lot of these policies, in particular as it addresses Black immigrants, because most other people don't have that. And it does impact us differently than it impacts other folks in terms of these policies being pushed at this moment. We also have KYR information in language, videos in language. If folks want to support with helping us to create more of those, please look out for the trainings, the workshops that we're going to be doing for emergency preparedness and for organizing and base building. You can go to Instabaji as well as following us in terms of our website and on Facebook. Thank you so much again for having us on the show.
Thank you so much, Victor.
Yeah.
We started with you. Let's finish with you.
Yeah. So the Labor Center website is www.labor.ucla.edu. One thing I want to point out, I further mentioned this earlier, but fear creates loneliness. Loneliness is an outcome of fear, and I just think we should also reach out to community members, like make sure we're all in community together, and because there's a lot of fear out there. And when you see somebody, one of the activists, or overwhelmed, getting burned out, starting to feel lonely in the struggle, especially today, just reach out to that person and be there for that person. Because that's solidarity building too, is to help overcome the loneliness that can happen with the fear.
I can't thank you enough for that. You know, and it's also, you know, you talk about loneliness, and you also talked about the role of immigrant workers now in going to the sites and exposing themselves in all sorts of ways to help clean up from the fires. And that exposes them both to toxic materials, but also to possibly being rounded up if we see this thing come to fruition. So, and then of course the last point about all of that, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to have this show. We're only a few days into this administration, and I'm already seeing much of the left deflated, anxious, feeling like too many of the Democrats in Congress are caving into all of this. You know, on the appointments, they were on the, you know, saying we have to be bipartisan. And, you know, somehow Trump is legitimate. So that's a really important message. And I want to thank all of you. Let me just tell our listeners. So this will all be up. We'll make the information available. But we've had Victor Naro with us, nationally known expert on immigrant issues, working in in the sanctuary movement. And he's also the project director for the UCLA Labor Center. Nana Giamfi is also a programmer at KPFK and is the executive director of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, which is BAJI. And they're doing just amazing work. And I really hope that you go to the website, because I can't hope to describe it all right now in this very short outro. And thanks so much for making time and coming to join us today, Aki. That's Akilina Soriano-Versosa, of the executive director of the Filipino Workers Center of Southern California, working to not only protect domestic workers from all kinds of labor violations, human trafficking, but also to create a rapid response network and come together with other organizations to protect immigrants at this time. Thank you all for your work. It's really the hope, and it just makes me want to cry, so I'm not going to say anything more. But thanks for joining me today on the program. I'm Susie Wiseman. And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guests, Victor Naro, Nana Giamfi, and Akilina Soriano-Versosa. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Gary Baca in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page. That's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Susie Wiseman. Thank you.